Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Thanks for joining us on the one-on-one Inside Lacrosse Podcast. John Gelati here. And before we get to this week's very special guest, just a quick reminder that you can find all of our podcasts online at iTunes if you search Inside Lacrosse, and also at insidelacrosse.com/podcast. We encourage you to share these on social media via Twitter and Facebook. You can tag Inside Lacrosse, inside_lacrosse on Twitter, and also my handle is JJILOTY. Whether it's Pinterest, Reddit, LinkedIn, whatever else strikes your fancy, please spread these around. And if you have any questions, suggestions, comments, please feel free to email me at jgelati@insidelacrosse.com. Now, on to our special guest this week. It is Dick Adell, Hall of Famer and two-time USILA Coach of the Year, one of the most respected men in lacrosse. Was nice enough to join us this week in advance of the Virginia-Maryland game live on ESPNU at 2 o'clock on Saturday. You can see live coverage of that on InsideLacrosse.com. So we want to thank Coach Adell, big man, for joining us, and thank you for listening in. Welcome to the one-on-one Inside Lacrosse Podcast. John Gelati here, joined today by the great Dick Adell, big man known to many, former Maryland, longtime Maryland coach, 18 years with the Terps, Hall of Famer, two-time USILA Coach of the Year, and a legend in the game. Coach, thanks for joining us. How you doing?
I'm doing awesome, John. Great to be with you.
Nice. Well, we had a chance to catch up with Coach this past weekend at the Conoco Minolta Faceoff Classic in Baltimore. I thought it'd be a good chance to follow up and talk about some of the stuff that we talked about. Let's kind of just start off and talk about, you get to watch some games. What is your take on the new rules this year in college lacrosse?
I'll tell you, John, I'm really, really excited about the changes that have come about in the game that have been brought on by these, tinkering with the rules. I love the fact that they've gotten rid of the horns, that it's a lot of continual play. I like the moving too quick on the face off to punish the team for the third time they've done it in a half. I love the timer on, forcing you to play the game, and not be so methodical on the offensive end. I think the only thing I'm not happy with, I think this will change, maybe not this year, because I don't think they are allowed to change the rules, but every 2 years. But I think we're going to have to put a visible clock up. In other words, other than being with you last weekend, I've done nothing but watch college games on TV. And when the timer is on, the guy that counts down the last 10 seconds with a visual hand movement, like a basketball referee, he's a trail official, and he's not really in the field of vision for the TV. So you're trying to guess, how much time is left, and that's amateurish, I think. We got to do one of two things. Hopefully, as we get to the postseason, they'll post, when that timer on the hand signal goes up, I'd like to see them put a 30-second visual clock like they do with man down. But when they do it with man down, you've got time to get organized. The penalty's called, they come over and report it to the box, as opposed to, I don't know if you could do it immediately, immediately put that 30-second clock on when the hands go up. That's the only criticism I would have. And I mean, overall, I think it's a better game because of these changes.
Great. Yeah, it definitely seems like things have sped up a little bit. And, the common refrain I've gotten from a lot of people is the same shot clock comment that if we're going to have a shot clock, we should probably have a shot clock. We'll see what happens there. What have you seen? Your Terps started off the year pretty well until last weekend, a little bit of a slip up against Carolina, but heading into this weekend's Virginia matchup, what have you seen out of Maryland so far, and what do you think of their start?
I got to argue with you. I don't think it was a pretty good start. I think it's a phenomenal start, but particularly in the kind of season up until last Saturday that. The 2013 season has been. I have a theory on last Saturday, and that is that last week is spring break, and there aren't too many worse places to be than a 30,000 person campus. You know, when 29,000, 700 people are gone, I've experienced it personally almost two decades. It's, you're trying to come up with a movie, a bowling team outing, the things to keep the kids, in the regular routine. And I thought, and I'm not taking anything away from North Carolina. They played well, particularly that attack unit, but that performance was so out of character with everything that Maryland's done so far that I'm sort of writing that one off to the vacation. I think this weekend is interesting. It's a great rivalry. Remember, and it wasn't too long ago that this game produced the longest lacrosse game in history, longest college game in history. I think we're going to get well. You and I watched Virginia, I can't say jump out, but to an 8-1 deficit. But we watched 30 minutes of the Wahoos on the short end of an 8-1 score, and I have concerns for them. I remember last year when Rob Pinnell went out, a excellent Cornell season went to hell. And even though Chris LaPierre is not a great offensive player, I would describe him as the greatest athlete in the sport at these 3 or 4 years that he's played. And he must be, another thing, and I haven't talked to Tom about this, very seldom does a team have a single captain, and Chris was that. And I think, that has to affect them. That was not a great, Cavalier performance, and they got the pressure on them, John, because they sit at 5-4 right now. And I know they have Bellarmine still to play, but first it's going to be Maryland, Carolina, Duke, then Carolina, Maryland, or Duke again in the first round of the tournament. So you could be staring at an ineligibility for postseason very easily. This could be a pretty fierce competition Saturday at 2:00.
Absolutely. Now you've, having coached at Maryland for 18 years and having known Dom Sarja for a long time, I would imagine. How do you kind of typify the Virginia Maryland rivalry, just in terms of what that's been like to coach and to watch over the years?
It's been a good one. Our relationship is one of respect. And Proctor's a great venue to play in. Probably the best lacrosse venue, with size and the spirit that they get down there. It's always a tremendous crowd, where they fill the stadium and fill the opposite hill, from the benches, and we've had, like I said to you, we've had some great, I don't think any were more competitive than my successor, Dave Cottle's, 7 overtime game. But, and it actually goes back even before that, a guy that I really respected, and was a legend in the game, Ace Adams had the group, and we had some great, great games with them. And I'll be disappointed if this isn't another. I think both teams, both Maryland and Virginia, play this past weekend were aberrations. I think both are going to play a heck of a lot better, come Saturday afternoon.
Now, you know, you say that at a good time. I wanted to ask you about motivation, you know, from a coaching standpoint. You, I've read and heard over and over that you were, you know, a master motivator, pregame, practice, whatever it was, you know, your guys would, you know, the cliche goes, run through walls for you. Any tips to motivating and what were the kind of the keys to getting the kids fired up for, you know, at any time for anything, throughout your career?
My theory was always, and it really started years ago and just continued, till the end of my career was, you know, John, you might not always play well, you know, I think about hoops where you run a great play and get the open shot and the shot doesn't fall, you know, so you're not gonna play well all the time, but you can play hard all the time, and that's something that we really stressed, you know, and that was, we practiced hard and played hard, and I don't think that when I say practice hard, did you stay out there for 3 hours? I couldn't do anything for 3 hours. I don't think without getting bored, but. We were intense. We were intense, and you know, the greatest compliment you could give me at the end of a game, you know, was that your team played harder than the guy that we played against, and by and large, that carried us to success more times than not.
Now I know that you always kind of use the blue collar mentality, went after blue collar guys. Those were kind of the style of your programs, and your teams. I mean, what were the things that you did? And I know that, you know, as a funny story about how, you know, the dumpster duty that you had the guys do, picking up garbage after football games for some extra money for your lacrosse budget. I mean, were there things that you did to kind of, you know, keep that mindset and use that mentality as motivation?
And lie is not the word, but you embellish those stories, you know. I can tell you right now, on April the 12th, the night before the game on April the 13th, that I always told the guys, you know, beat them tomorrow because you might be working for those Blue Jays, you know, the rest of your life, which was never a truism, but hopefully they didn't think that deeply, you know, and before we played the Navals, you know, I mean, these guys are sacrifice themselves, you know, stepping in front of bullets and whatever, you know, we got to out tough them. Yeah. You know, just had a little fun with it. And you got to have fun. And you know that, and that's what makes, that's one of the things that makes our sport so great, because playing lacrosse is fun. You know, I coached football for 4 years at Calvert Hall back before you were born. And football's a drudgery. You know, you just repeat. You can't scrimmage, basically, because you're going to end up with nobody to play on the weekend. But, you know, what we do is practicing is fun, you know, and competing and, you know, I like to say that, you know, I did this for 35 years, and few people in when they get out can say that they did something they like doing with people they like doing it with, you know, for 35 years. And I felt strongly about it then, and I feel even more strong about it right now.
Nice. Well, I think your players speak to having enjoyed every minute they spent with you as well. So, any other pregame speeches stand out, or speeches that you gave in before games or halftime or on the field?
I do remember one. I can't tell you. My wife, she threatens me. You know, remember this is going to air sometime. But I do remember. Having a terrible, in the old days, when the football building at Bird Stadium now was our locker room, and we had one hellacious half against somebody, and my watch, which I never knew how to correctly take care of. As I am lighting these guys up at halftime, the alarm goes off on my watch, right? And I try and turn it off. I can't. I rip my watch off and throw it against the wall. And we turned it around second half, win the game. And Monday, you know, I go over to the locker room for something. It was about 30 steps from my office, and I go into the locker room, and on the wall is circled this dent. You know, it's written on the thing, the watch took a licking, but it kept on ticking. and it's a true story. We had some fun.
That's great. That's great. Now, you know, you and I talked a little bit about this on Saturday, but the, you know, Maryland's move to the pending move to the Big Ten, eminent move, I guess is a better way to say it, to the Big Ten. What is your take on that? A lot of tradition kind of being cast aside there for some football and TV and some financial reasons. But, what's been your reaction to that move?
I wish you wouldn't have asked me that, John. Well, I'm going to be 70 years old my next birthday, and I'm a traditionalist. You know, I find in today's sports world, you know, history starts when a new AD or a new coach comes in. You know, that they forget about, you know, what came before. And I always thought you should keep all of that alive. I'm sick over the fact that we're leaving. I'm literally sick over it. You know, I mean, the Maryland, Carolina, Duke, Virginia competitions, it was great stuff. And you know, it's made even more intense by our tournament where in your good year you were going to play two of the three twice. And then in real good years you were going to play probably three times, you know, with regular season, ACC, and then national playoffs. And, you know, we had something very special that was going to become the ultimate. You know, when think about those four teams and Syracuse and Notre Dame, my God, I just can't think of anything that could have been any better. I think this is a little bit of prostitution. You know, it's all, and they can talk about student athletes and academic implications and libraries and this, that, and the other. That's ball hockey, John. It's all about the Benjamins. And you know, I lose respect for athletic administrators and school presidents that don't tell the truth. And there's a little, you know, there's some subversion going on right now because the public wants to see the contract, and you know, Maryland won't provide it, nor will the Big Ten. I'm sorry I didn't ask you, but I'm always an honest guy with you, and I'm sorry it happened. And I don't know what in the hell is going to happen with, you know, they can't have a Big Ten league. You know, because there's not six teams. You've got the Ohio State, you know, the Penn State, Michigan, Maryland, and Rutgers. But comparing that with that Super League that we could have had, that's no comparison. I'm not mincing my words on that. I think it was a lousy move.
Ah, well, I appreciate the honesty, and, you know, you're not, obviously not alone in that sentiment, and it sounds like there's a lot of movement still left to go, and, you know, maybe, you know, I keep hearing Virginia, Carolina maybe going to the Big Ten, and I think that there's all sorts of other movement elsewhere.
Yeah.
Who knows?
But, you know, and the thing is, don't ever forget, this decision had nothing whatsoever to do with lacrosse. It was all about football and dollars and cents, and we were a byproduct. And actually, in a sense, it's going to help Maryland women's lacrosse because they're going to they can move into a league possibly, you know, with the 7-time national champion, Northwestern.
Yeah.
You know, so but time will tell.
Yeah, I hope it ends up working out somehow. And you know, hey, maybe the positive is that, you know, Minnesota picks up the sport at the men's level and hops in. You know, I know that that's maybe unlikely, but, you know, maybe that's a positive byproduct out of all this. I don't know, but.
You and I have driven to Durham or driven to Chapel Hill. You and I have never driven to Minneapolis.
That's true. That is very true. It's a little bit of a tougher trip.
If you're going, you're going by yourself, okay? Don't call me.
I will, I'll cross you off the list. I mentioned in some of the newer programs, you know, there's been some growth at the men's Division I level lately, you know, Richmond and Boston University, Marquette, Monmouth, High Point, some of these programs we're finally seeing some growth at the men's D1 level, and we're also seeing a lot of parity, I think, you know, just more teams being able to beat each other and less.
You gotta be fired up about that, John. I mean, anybody that loves the sport, it's core. You know, it reminds you a little bit about of NCAA basketball this year. You know, nobody knows who's going to, you know, to pull this thing out. And, you know, I think back to not even 20 years ago, but years back, if I said to you on, you know, March the 25th, when you open your top 20 up, the United States Naval Academy, the United States Military Academy, and Georgetown are nowhere to be seen, and the Denvers and the Colgates and the Lehighs and the Bucknells and the Fairfields are, holy cow. Holy cow. It's great for the game. It's great for the game. And, you know, I think, and I may have my numbers wrong on this, but I think there's 3,300 high school programs today. When you take into account the number of players that they're going to produce, you know, and the talent level. Think about a year like last year when our Towariton Award recipient is from Oregon. You know, the best long pole in America right now, arguably, is from Miami, Florida. You know, the starting goalie at tradition, you know, rich Johns Hopkins, Arizona. You know, this is great. You know, and I think it's extra great when the Marquettes and the Furmans and the like. And gosh, I saw the Atlantic Sun's gonna play a league seat. You know, a lacrosse league. We have to be the fastest growing sport, and you and I are just talking guys. The women's even quicker growing. You know, the women's lacrosse. So it's a great time for the game.
Absolutely, and you know, of course, you were talking about Peter Baum and Jesse Bernhardt and Pierce Bassett. You know, there's countless other guys from, you know, Chase Carrero from Kentucky and Rob Emery from California. You can almost name, you know, Brandon.
The guy on that came in on the first Rex. From Johns Hopkins. I think he's Minnesota.
Yep, Rex Sanders, yep.
Rex Sanders, yeah. Well, can you think of anything greater for the game? You know, it's awesome. And if we live long enough, maybe we'll become a national sport.
Yeah, hopefully. What was the key for you recruiting back when you were trying to identify talent and pick up guys for the Terps?
You know, I mean, our prime goal was to recruit an athlete. You know, we always felt, that athleticism. If we get a good athlete, and you start to work with him, fall and spring, and fall, winter and spring, the way it is right now, that if the guy's a good athlete, he can become an even better player. I mean, that's something that threw me off a little bit sometimes when we were working with what's now the MIAA, which was the MSA in our era. You know, sometimes you made some of these prep school kids that have been at St. Paul's or Gilman since preschool, you know, that guy was way ahead of the public school kid that may have not have, remember this, the youth and wasn't as prevalent as it is now, but you know, sometimes you you took a kid from a public school that wasn't that kind of player yet, but was a tremendous athlete, and his best lacrosse came in college, or sometimes you even see it now, some of those kids that are great athletes to start a little bit later, their best lacrosse is when they become a pro. So, I mean, if you said the one thing more than anything else that we searched for was athleticism, and you and I share a mutual friend, you know, one of the lieutenants to Kevin Plank at Under Armour is Kit Foulkes, who was a star of our 94 and 95 teams, and as good an athlete as I ever coached, that criteria always worked for us. Get the athlete, and I think the thing that I'm seeing change a little bit now, John, you don't get an attackman or a midfielder. You can offensive player or a defensive player, you know, and then fit him in to your scheme. In other words, when in our day, we might have played with three attackmen and three midfielders. Now they're playing with six offensive players and six defensive players. That's probably the biggest change I see from our era, which was 12 years ago to now.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, and you know, you bring up Kip. Kip was a JUCO guy with not a ton of lacrosse experience, I don't think, coming in, and you know, you guys were able to kind of mold him into you know, a really outstanding player who got.
Yeah, don't give credit to the coach. from a Northern Virginia, and Northern Virginia has good programs now, but that was grassroots at that point in time, and that's his community college. He came to our place and worked his fanny off, and I'd be less than honest with you if I didn't say he's as good an athlete as I ever coached.
Wow, nice. Well, yeah, he hit hard and shot hard and ran fast. Those are three pretty important characteristics.
And probably a better human being than he was as a lacrosse player.
Yeah, absolutely. And has gone on to pretty good things.
Now, if he would just send his old coach some more clothes, do better on the praise.
Nice. I like the plug. That's we'll make sure that I'll make sure I email this to him so he
make sure this plays an Under Armour.
Yes, absolutely. Now you are also involved with the Toroton Foundation, the Toroton Selection Committee, heading that up, helping head that up. Now this year, Toroton is honoring Bob Scott at the ceremony on May 30th. I know that you have known Coach Scott for a while, and what can you say about him and what he's meant to the game?
Do we have another hour?
As much time as you need.
Coach Scott, growing up, or the early years as a coach, he became my idol, you know, because he was a successful coach who was just as good a husband and just as good a father, you know, and a probably even better friend, you know. He and I have become very close over time, and I can't think of any human being that more deserves to be honored by the folks over at Toroton than Scotty. In fact, one of his all-time, maybe the best athlete that ever played at Hopkins, Joe Cowan, is going to be honored as well as we try and make up for some athletes that deserved a Toroton when there wasn't a Toroton, you know, with the Jim Browns and the like. Jim Browns and Mike French's, and Joe certainly fits into that category. It's going to be a Blue Jay evening over there. I mentioned to Petro a couple of weeks ago, and I didn't want to put any pressure on him, you know. Now it would be a grand slam, you know, if a Hopkins guy, you know, won the award. But we'll see. It's too early to discuss that.
Absolutely, yes. And Joe Cowan will be the Toroton legend this year, and Bob Scott will receive the Spirit of Toroton Award.
And you know, Joe had a tryout with the Baltimore Colts as a receiver slash punter. He could do it all.
That's crazy.
Great player.
Yeah, looking forward to that ceremony on May 30th. Any other stories that you have that jump out in your head that you want to kind of retell on this podcast to some old players and fans out there that might want to hear some favorites that you've told?
Dolores, my wife, my roommate, and head coach for all the wins. She didn't have anything to do with the losses. You know, she said that. Don't make it an R-rated show. I've had the good fortune of coaching at Calvert Hall, an unbelievable experience for a public school Protestant boy, to have a Mike Farrell and a Doug Radebaugh and, the Franz Wittelsbergers and the Dale Kohlers, and then, you know, I get to do it over at the University of Baltimore, and I will share one story with you. When I go to BU in 1972, I have to meet with the president, Matt Turner, a wonderful man, and he said, "Coach, to justify your salary, you're going to coach. We want you to coach two sports." And I said, "No problem, Dr. Turner, I'll help with basketball. I played a little bit at Dundalk High School, but I'm one of those guys that, jumped as high as a sheet of paper, off the ground." But, he said, "No, you're going to be the head soccer coach." And I said, "Cheese and crackers." I might have said something worse than that. But I said, "Golly, if you check my resume, I've never played soccer. I've never coached soccer. And if the truth be told, I don't think I like soccer." And the guy said, "Don't worry about it. He said, you condition them, you discipline them, and it'll take care of itself." And John, the first practice, we had to practice preseason at 6 o'clock at night, because everybody worked for, and all my guys were from Baltimore, and the majority of them from Baltimore City, and with a couple of my foreigners, I called them, were from Baltimore County. And I set them under a tree, and I said, in the shade there, and told them what we were going to do, and set up a couple standards, and then go out, and we had the practice, and as we're done with the practice, We're in the conditioning, and as we get moving through the conditioning, I said, "All right, now this is for the fourth quarter, hell, they don't have quarters in soccer, so I would have been exposed, in my first practice." That group takes me to three Final Fours, and in December of 1975. We win the national championship below the Space Needle in Seattle, Washington. I learned early on that if you have good chicken, it's easy to make chicken salad. and I had good chicken, and it's just an unbelievable experience.
Nice. Well, congratulations on that championship. What one last question, in terms of lacrosse, getting over the hump, to me, the format of the Final Four is so unique in having to play a game, playing a championship game a couple days after your semifinal game, just that in-between day is weird, and just in general, the whole format is so different from anything else that you do in lacrosse in terms of playing twice in three days. What was your experience in doing that? And I know, not successfully on Monday, but, what do you think is the difference in teams that are successful, on championship day?
Our win in 95 over Hopkins, almost shutting out Loyola God, what year was it? We were the world's greatest semifinal team. Okay? And might be the world's worst final team, and we tried it all, practice on Sunday, no practice, pray on Sunday, I think you're wise, and some of the guys are doing this now where they're playing in some of these things where you play on a Friday and a Sunday, you know, where that's good preparation. I'll tell you, John, from personal experience, there's not a whole lot you can do on that Sunday, you know, physically. If you're as spent as you can be, gosh, if you were in the second game, you know, you didn't get off the field till almost dinner time, you know, Saturday night, and I don't have any. You got to ask Billy, you got to ask the Slugger, you know, some of those guys that it worked for. I'll help you on Saturday. I'll give you some plenty. I always thought Saturday was easy because it was the same as a regular season. You know, at the worst, you played the Sunday before. And many times you may have played the Saturday before. But you had that week to put your game plan in and work on all your motivation things. You know, you don't have that. Particularly when, say, the two teams in the other game, and particularly when you were the second game, the two teams in the other game may not be in the conference, you know, then you were really in trouble with scouting-wise and things of that nature. It's a challenge. I personally, if I would rather have another week, but that's not the way it is. But I'm also the guy that said, I believe we started this in 1986. I may stand to be corrected on that, but I think the Final Four came in about 86. And I know somebody asked me about it in 85, and I said, that's horrible. But if you lose, take your narrow-sightedness of your own proprietary interest in your own team. If you said, what's good for the sport? This is spectacular. You know, that we can bring, you know, 100,000 people together over a 3-day period and have not just championships, but a flat out festival. You know, you remember, you may not remember, but when we started in for a while there, it was always at our place. You know, it was always at Bird Stadium almost every year. And to think that, we would outgrow that and be able to play in these professional venues is, you know, it's just awesome for our sport, and shows you what I knew back in 1984 or whenever I asked to comment on it. It's made our sport unique and it's made it special.
Absolutely, and hopefully we can get the crowds back trending positively this Memorial Day weekend in Philadelphia. Your Terps will be there. Based on how they've started, it's definitely looking good. So,
I hope you're right, JJ.
Well, thank you so much for the time, Coach. Always a pleasure. And we'll keep following along with the Tourton all year and keep following the Terps. But thanks so much for the time.
If I don't see you before, I'll see you at the Museum of the American Indian.
May 30th. Can't wait.
It's a date.
Perfect.
Thanks, Johnny. Take care.
Inside the Cross Podcast.